On February 14th, a group of concerned citizens opposing the Keystone XL pipeline visited the Columbus office of Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown. Andrew Seidsinger works with 350.org here in Columbus, Ohio.
We delivered 1,800 350.org petitions against Keystone XL, and we have over 20,000 in general from all the 35 partner organizations in Ohio. And you know, we just gave him the message that if we want good jobs, clean energy jobs, we have to stop being behind fossil fuels and start being behind clean energy.
Joining Seidsinger for the visit to Sherrod Brown's office was Jason Box, a climatologist at The Ohio State University. Box said the tar sands are a pool of carbon as large as that of Saudi Arabia.
We cannot release this carbon to the atmosphere without locking in additional dangerous amounts of warming in our climate system.
Box said now's the time to have policy that will build a clean energy infrastructure.
The renewable energy infrastructure that we need, it can employ millions of Americans in long-term jobs.
Box said this view is supported by the facts. He said he visited Sherrod Brown's office to send a clear message against Keystone XL as a scientist and as a concerned citizen. Alec Johnson said it would be a smart move for Sherrod Brown to take a stand against Keystone XL.
Poll after poll shows that when you explain to people, among other things, the truth about the Keystone XL pipeline, they oppose it. They want clean energy job production. They understand where our future is going to be generated, and it's not by looking towards these technologies from the past.
Johnson said there is an enormous amount of misinformation about Keystone XL. He said oil companies are lying in order to build support for the pipeline, and that the companies seek to risk damage to public health and the environment to make big profits by selling the tar sands oil to foreign countries.
This is a bad deal for Americans, it's a bad deal for Ohioans, it's a bad deal for the world, and we mean to oppose it, we mean to stop it.
A couple of weeks earlier, Johnson took part in a protest against Keystone XL, which took place at the Westchester office of Republican Congressman John Boehner. Johnson said Boehner is the poster boy for big oil corruption in Congress.
He's received an enormous amount of money from the fossil fuel lobby. He does their bidding routinely, predictably. This is just nuts.
Danny Berchenko of 350.org said Boehner has taken more than $1 million from the fossil fuel industry during his time in Congress.
He also has hundreds of thousands of personal investments in big oil companies which stand to benefit from tar sands extraction.
Johnson said what Boehner is doing is a form of insider trading.
If you and I engaged in this kind of behavior, we'd go to prison. Instead, he's going to wind up making money by taking advantage of, you know, our public trust and abusing it.
Boehner's office has not responded to requests for comment from WCRS. Berchenko said Boehner has used legislative schemes to push Keystone XL forward, such as holding the payroll tax extension hostage.
And so it's clear that, you know, the money that he's taking from the fossil fuel industry and the money that he's personally invested into the fossil fuel industry is absolutely affecting his judgment when it comes to his leadership in Congress.
Berchenko said if Boehner were truly representing the interests of his constituents, he would not be blocking attempts at regulating carbon emissions and otherwise addressing the climate crisis. Berchenko said Boehner is touting false numbers about the amount of jobs Keystone XL will create.
He's claiming 20,000 jobs will be created by it. Those are numbers based off of a biased study by the company who stands to actually build the pipeline if the permit is approved. The actual jobs numbers, when you look at independent analysis, show that at most, building this pipeline would create 5,000 temporary jobs, at most, and really only 50 permanent jobs.
Berchenko said Keystone XL might kill more jobs than it creates because of running over sensitive farmland, including a key aquifer used for irrigation. He said the existing Keystone pipeline has leaked 12 times in the past year, and that XL is not likely to be any better. Berchenko said a real job solution would involve legislation that creates incentives for investments into wind, solar, and retrofitting buildings for increased energy efficiency.
Those are jobs that can't be shipped overseas. We have to hire people to retrofit our buildings here because we can't uproot a building and send it over to China to then be retrofitted.
Danny Berchenko of 350.org, Ohio. On February 14th, food sovereignty activist and author Eric Holt Jimenez spoke at The Ohio State University. WCRS recorded the following conversation between Jimenez and Avery Lewis, who is a manager at Global Gallery in Clintonville.
Is it worth it to invest our time in looking at market-based approaches to development, or should we be focusing on transforming the systems so that it's not a market-based approach, so that it's something different?
Yeah. Okay, so we can't afford to ignore markets. Markets are very important, right? But a market-based approach to development has serious limitations. So we can't transform the market through the market. So we have to transform the market through rules, regulations on the market. That's how we change the market. So even though fair trade, for example, has been a tremendous experiment and has had tremendous value in terms of educating people in the North about their food dollar or their coffee dollar or whatever it might be, it's been captured by larger corporate interests to a large degree in order to increase the market power of the fair trade dollar. And the problem is that rather than fair trade raising the bar on the corporations have dropped the bar on fair trade, right? And so the market is now transforming fair trade rather than fair trade transforming the market. So that's the pitfall of a market-based approach.
Do you think the same thing is true of microfinance?
No, absolutely. And so what we're seeing now is that if you don't pay attention to the structural issues of the market or protecting your agriculture or protecting your farmers and whatnot, then if you simply give them more credit, you just drive them deeper into debt. And so the home of
98.7% repayment rate, higher than any loan ever.
So that's very good for the people who gave the loan. That's not necessarily for the people who are paying off the loan. Right? So when you look in Uttar Pradesh, for example, now, the home of microfinance, you find that women are being smothered under layers of debt because they have microfinance to pay off microfinance to pay off microfinance. And the reason is because there is no productive economy for them. So as long as they keep getting these loans, but their local economy is not protected, they just drive themselves deeper and deeper into debt. And yes, they pay it off because they get another loan to pay it off. And now some of the happiest people in Uttar Pradesh are the old money lenders, right? Because now people are going back to the old money lenders to be able to pay off microfinance. So the microfinance industry is doing quite well. The borrowers are not. So you can't...
I don't mean to argue with you. I don't know, I guess is what I'm saying. I'm finding different people are saying different things all the time, and Muhammad Yunus would tell you the complete opposite, that the borrowers are actually benefiting immensely from microfinance and that they are able to pay off their loans.
No, but that's just it. So you can look at this particular study, if you like, I can send it to you, done in Uttar Pradesh, and it's in the Journal of Agrarian Change. And basically, it says, yes, they pay off their loans. One, those loans are not cheap. Those are very expensive loans. So these are not cheap loans. And there's a difference between microcredit. Yes, interest rates are very high. So there's a difference between microcredit and microfinance, right? So, you know, and Yunus is furious with microfinance because it's making money off the poor. But it's what has taken over. So microcredit opened up the markets, and then microfinance took over the markets, all right? And so now you have private sector in making money off poor people. And the rates are very high. They're almost usurious, quite frankly. And people pay them off, right? But that doesn't mean that people are better off because they're paying them off. And in fact, what has happened is they take out more loans to pay off the loans, and they sink deeper and deeper into debt. And this particular article makes the argument that one of the reasons they sink deeper into debt is because their economy is unprotected. And so you can't expect to recover an economy just by loaning people money if you leave the economy unprotected.
So where do I begin?
But that's the conversation we've had here today, is that if we just do the practical things without making the structural changes, you know, in a sense, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. So many of the farmers that I worked with, who are excellent farmers, you know, it's not a technological problem at all, and they produce 4 and 5 times as much as other farmers, are producing now at 10-20% capacity because they can't get a price for their corn, because U.S. corn is being dumped, and that's a structural issue. So if you don't protect that market, it doesn't matter how good a farmer you are. Yeah. And I think that the analogy is the same with microfinance. There's nothing wrong with microfinance per se. It could be quite good under conditions.
The way the Grameen Bank did, maybe it would.
Well, if the economy was being protected, but the economy is not being protected, and these people can't compete with a global economy. There's no way. So you're sort of condemning them to poverty, condemning them to debt, unless you address these other issues. So I don't think it's an issue of microfinance. I think we've over-dimensionalized what microfinance can do, and now it's sort of coming back to bite people.
Food sovereignty activist Eric Holt Jimenez, calling for systemic change to global food policy. He was speaking with Avery Lewis. Lewis is a manager at Global Gallery in Clintonville. Holt Jimenez said globalization has led to increased concentration of wealth.
If 10 years ago we had, you know, 500 billionaires, now we have 1,100 billionaires. So this liberalization has not been good for the planet or for society, and now we've got these crashes and the inability to address some very serious crises, the fuel crises, the food crises, the climate crises.
He said there is no possibility for reform unless we have a strong movement to counter economic neoliberalism.
To introduce reforms, you need political will. And political will is not just what one politician wants to do. It's what society will allow politicians to do. And to introduce reforms, as Roosevelt introduced with the New Deal, basically you need massive public support.
Getting massive public support for reforms of our political and economic system requires alliances between progressives and people on the left who call themselves radicals, said Holt Jimenez.
That was the case with the New Deal. Roosevelt didn't introduce it just because he had a good idea. It's because it looked like this government was going to fall because of all the social protests. Right? So the tremendous social movement which introduced these reforms. Now, that social movement was built by the alliance between progressives and radicals, not between progressives and reformists.
He said alliances between progressives and reformists merely strengthen the status quo.
To change the system, you've got to have a counter-movement coming from the outside, which forces the reforms. So that's why radicals and progressives have to form strong alliances, to form a strong counter-movement that can create the political will that allows reformists even to act. But if you leave the radicals out on the fringe, then you don't have enough social weight to be able to advance reforms.
Holt Jimenez said not-for-profit organizations and the foundations that fund them are doing important work, but he said what they are doing is not enough to bring about systemic change.
What the funding has not done, it has not brought about a political convergence of all these different groups, and that's what we need today.
He said the progressive movement 80 or 100 years ago was more radical than what we have today. He said back then, progressives got to the root of political and economic issues and pressured governments to make systemic change.
The folks, for example, in the food movement that are the most radical, that go to the root of the problem, are those who ally themselves with food sovereignty, whereas progressives tend to be more about food justice. And I think food access, you know, and equitable food access, whereas food sovereignty is more about we need to take back control over the food system. We don't need just access. We need to ensure access in the future for everybody, and we do that by taking back control of the system, by looking at the structures which control our food system.
Holt Jimenez said social movements around the world are entering what he refers to as a second wave.
First waves of social change came about with the great labor struggles and the struggles for national liberation and the struggles for the capture of state power in order to introduce reforms. But those happened, you know, over the last 50 years in the past, but over the last 25 years or so, those forms of organizations have been less and less effective at introducing social change.
He said this new second wave of social movements is more diverse than the first wave.
It's not just about labor. It's not just about capitalists, about gender and race and environment and all these other things.
He said such diversity makes current social movements more fragmented than those in the past.
What we need to find is convergence in all of this diversity in order to be a powerful enough social movement in our collectivity to introduce the changes, the systemic changes and the structural changes.
The convergence requires a pluralistic politics, said Holt Jimenez.
We're not going to be able to have the sort of unilateral, vertical, sort of ideological forms of organization that social change groups used to have in the during the first wave. And so we're going to need to find new forms of accepting different positions while moving forward in the same movement.
He said activism on the ground today is moving ahead of the theories of those who study social movements.
This notion of convergence and diversity comes from observation of where different social movements are converging in all of their diversity and actually advancing change. And so theorists are struggling to understand this new phenomenon in the face of, you know, really the contradictions of capital and the inability of our present system to resolve the major problems of the world today.
Holt Jimenez said activists and other people living in developed nations have a lot to learn from peasant farmers. He said those farmers who are involved in the agrarian movements of the global south are very clear about the structural issues that affect their lives.
They may not be as clear about a lot of other things, like they may not know how to set up a CSA, or they may not necessarily know about agroecology, but they're very clear that their land has been taken away, that they've been forced into migration, that their livelihoods have been destroyed by a system which they can name and they can describe.
Holt Jimenez said peasant farmers in the global south also are clear about what systemic changes are needed to improve their lives.
For example, they need land reform. That's a structural change. They want agriculture out of the WTO. That's another structural change. This is the sort of political and structural clarity which I think we could learn a lot from here in the United States.
Eric Holt Jimenez, author and food sovereignty activist. He directs the not-for-profit Food First.